Senator Lisa Murkowski, thanks for joining us. You're in town here for the Alaska Outdoor Alliance Conference. What has been your biggest takeaway from the conference?
Well, I think what we are seeing here in Haines is a coming together of interests of those that are focused on Alaska's outdoor opportunities and how we really wholly integrate that. And I spoke at lunch about how we're connected, some of the ways, whether it's through our transportation, certainly through our marine highway system. That's how I came to Haines this morning. Whether it's aviation, whether it's road access, but it's how we come together, not only physically through those connections, but also through things like broadband, through the airwaves that we're moving this conversation through, and not only how we build these connections, but how we're able to make these opportunities available to not only our visitors, but to those of us who live and work and raise our families who call Alaska home. Some of the things that we get excited about, whether it's the opportunity for extended trail systems or again, some of the federal programs that we've put in place in recent years that allows for greater access to our public lands, greater care and greater stewardship for our public lands, how we're all working to partner together to provide access, but to take care of them as well.
Thank
good,
you.
Good gathering today, and we were just part of one of the several learning journeys, and to be part of not only the history of the tribal house here, the clan house, but the vision for the future and how that is integrated, and how the Native people within the region here will be incorporated as part. Well, not only be incorporated, I think that's the wrong way to phrase it, but to be building together with one another, preserving language and culture and traditions, and moving that into a future with a shared vision. It's kind of exciting to see.
And I had a question for you about the ferries, which people in Haines care dearly about.
Rightly so.
And you mentioned the infrastructure bill in your speech today, and I know you've touted the work you did on that in getting funding for the ferry system. I think people are wondering sort of how long before that money translates into more frequent, reliable ferry service in the Upperland Canal, more than just a couple ferries a month in the winter.
The people of Southeast, the people in our coastal communities deserve to have reliable, affordable marine highway system. It has been something that has been part of this region since I was a kid growing up here, and in fairness, there is no reason that we should not have a good, sound ferry system in the state of Alaska. Given all that we have, the resources that we have, it is, in my view, a shame that our system has been allowed to really founder in a way that you can't build ridership because you can't get a reliable schedule. And then you've got issues like dynamic pricing that really price people out of an opportunity to travel in that way. So your question is a fair one. When are we going to see the money? Well, this is what we are doing now, allowing the contours of the programs that we have put in place through the infrastructure law, the criteria. Eligibility, timelines, all of that is coming together. In fact, I'm not sure what I think it was last week, no, excuse me, it was the 6th of September, was the deadline for comment on some of the aspects of the ferry program. But what people need to remember is we're going to be in a situation here where it's not only programmatic funding that will be included as part of an ongoing funding source for operation for the Alaska Marine Highway System. That will be in place. But then we also have specific funding to establish essential ferry service. So we're very familiar with essential air service. We're doing the same thing when it comes to our ferry systems, not just in Alaska, but in other areas where it's deemed to be essential. So that will be a source of funding within this five-year bill. We also have funding for a pilot program for electric or low-emitting ferries, one of which of these pilots has to be located in Alaska. So you're going to see an initiative building out on electric or low-emitting ferry. You're going to have the authorized federal highway aid for the Alaska Marine Highway System for operations and repairs. That's in as soon as we pass the appropriations bill. As soon as the appropriations bill starts coming through, that programmatic funding starts to flow. And then the additional support for our essential ferry service, we should be receiving $73 million from that level of funding as well. So you've got operational money, you've got support for an electric or low emitting pilot, which will be separate, and then you have additional funding for the essential. Southeast Conference is going to be meeting in Ketchikan next week. There's going to be a great deal of focus on just exactly the build out of the system. From the federal perspective, what I can do to help as not only an appropriator, but one who helped design and pass this infrastructure bill, we can move federal resources. The state of Alaska is the one that has to establish the contours of this system. You don't want the federal government running your Alaska Marine Highway System. But this is where the state has really got to come together. The state has really got to do its visioning thing. It's got to put a framework in place for sustainability. Some of this money is ongoing, reoccurring funds that you'll be able to count on. That's a first. But some of this is part of the five-year money that is coming from this infrastructure bill, that we've got a window of opportunity to take it now, and I am pushing everyone from the governor on down in this administration to please seize this moment. The Alaska Marine Highway System is too important to this region, and not just this region. It's up in Prince William Sound, it's out in Kodiak, it's down in the Aleutians. We can do better. We can do better as a state in providing for highway service. And that highway service in our coastal communities is marine highway. So I'm urging people, come together with our system that's going to be sustainable with these federal resources that we have available for us right now. So people are looking to me for a lot, and I will continue to push this rock uphill and get as much as I possibly can in federal dollars. But we've got to have a system that will be sustainable. When I was living down here in Southeast, we as a state didn't have oil wealth. We didn't have our permanent fund. But what we had was we had a way that families could get around reliably and affordably. If we could make our marine system float back then, there's no reason why. When we've got a permanent fund that is billions of dollars, we have extraordinary wealth, we can figure this one out. We have to prioritize it. I have made it a priority at the federal level. The state needs to prioritize this as our transportation system for our coastal communities.
Thanks.
Sorry I gave you such a long-winded answer, but I really care about this.
The gist, though, is you feel you've done a lot. You've gotten the money, and now we're at a point where the state needs to sort of figure out how to use that money and optimize the...
They have to optimize. They have to seize this opportunity that we have. And we've got task forces. I had a good opportunity to meet with the Commissioner of Transportation yesterday. We had an infrastructure symposium in Anchorage, and it was focused on all aspects of the infrastructure bill. But it was interesting to me that as the Transportation Commissioner, he chose to give about half, it seemed like about half of his comments to the marine highway system and the value that it created. He indicated that there was, that they were working on many aspects of what I have just outlined in terms of what needs to happen for a longer-term vision. And I was encouraged by his words. I'm hopeful here. But again, as one who spent the 4 hours on the ferry this morning coming up from Juneau, talking to people who were coming up, some were coming up for the Klondike Relay. Mm-hmm. Some were using the ferry to go out and about and do just a little getaway weekend. Others were coming up here to go to work. They'd been in Juneau for business and just moving back and forth. This is a reminder to us of how our Alaska Marine Highway System is being used. I spent about 45 minutes up on the bridge talking with the captain and the first mate and the AB, I forget what the AB, able-bodied seaman, I guess, talking about what their future was, mm-hmm. how they viewed the Marine Highway System. There was one guy who's still getting his license, and he's been working for the ferry for 1 year now, and young man out of Ketchikan. He views this as his future, which excites me. The others were 17 years, 16 years. The captain was 16 years. One guy was 22 years there. They've been working on our marine highway system for a long while, but they want to believe that system is going to be there for them as well. Mm-hmm. So you got to have the crew. You got to have the riders. It's got to be affordable. It's got to be reliable.
Thanks.
According to the Congressional Budget Office, the bill would increase deficits by $256 billion between 2021 and 2031. And the current administration has been criticized for their spending policies, increasing inflation. Speaking locally, we came near $7 a gallon for gas here, and it's actually $9 a gallon for a gallon of milk. It's actually cheaper to drink that gallon of gas than it is milk. How did you weigh the benefits that Alaskans would receive against the increase in national spending and the contribution to high inflation?
Well, those of us that were working on the infrastructure bill were very purposeful in making sure that what we were funding, what we were building out, was not going to be contributing to inflation. Because as we were working on this, inflation was not at the record levels that we see today. It has dipped just a little bit below, but it's still record inflation. And so what we were working to do, again, was to make sure that this was not just kind of a short-term shot in the arm economic one-time stimulus, that what we were doing was investment, legacy investment. a road that you are building, a bridge that will be in place for the next 40 years, an airport that will allow for economic growth. We factored all of this in. A water and wastewater system does not contribute to inflation like a one-time a payout of a loan forgiveness type of a thing. And so there was a great deal of debate among the 10 members, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, who built this, about what should go in and what should not go in. And one of the prime criterias was, is this going to be an inflationary creator or a dampener? And that was an important part of our review and our analysis. And so I do push back when people say all this has done is contributed to a level of spending that has added to inflation. Where I think we did see contributors to inflation was they called it the American Rescue Plan in 2021. It passed as a wholly partisan bill, and it was not what we would consider to be legacy infrastructure investment. It was more one-time stimulus dollars. This Inflation Reduction Act that was passed just about a month ago, again, also on a wholly partisan basis through the reconciliation process, that is, you know, not a full $1 trillion the ARP bill was, but you are again, through that measure, even though it's called the Inflation Reduction Act, what you have are increased levels of short-term spending that I am fearful will contribute further to higher rates of inflation. The spending is real and legitimate, and again, we've got to be stewards of the federal taxpayer dollars. But I am one who is prepared to say that when those dollars, those federal dollars, your taxpayer dollars, are made as investments in your community for a long period of time, that helps to stimulate economic growth and is a dampener to inflation.
Just a quick follow-up. Is there any plan among your colleagues or those on the other side of the aisle to actually eventually get a hold of our debt, which has now grown over $30 trillion and probably double or triple that if we count in everything that has not been fully funded? Is there any plan to actually get a hold of our rampant spending?
Well, I wish that I could tell you that I think you're going to see leadership from the Biden administration on that, but I'm not seeing that. I am very empathetic to those who have incurred substantial student loan debt, but I think that the president's action in this recent decision to forgive up to $10,000 for some and up to $20,000 for others in student loan debt is not going to help us as we are reducing spending, because when the federal government forgives that debt, it's not as if it goes away. It just means that individual for whom received that one-time benefit, that golden ticket, it means that obligation is then distributed among the rest of us. So we didn't incur that debt, but we will now be obligated for that. And so I view things like that as a signal that at least from the administration's perspective, we're not going to see that effort to rein in further spending. And again, when you look at the bipartisan effort that I was intimately engaged in with our infrastructure bill, it was a very purposeful negotiation to avoid anything that would lead to inflationary pressure, recognizing the economic growth that comes when you are building something, you are creating jobs, you are creating that economic wealth, and you are leaving a legacy structure that continues to build value. We worked on that together on a bipartisan basis, and I think you're seeing the benefit across the country. We're certainly seeing it here in this state with the investments that are already underway. When it comes to the reconciliation measures that passed, two of them now, so you're close to $2 trillion in spending between those two measures. That to me does not indicate that there is a genuine effort to rein in spending by the majority right now.
I wanted to transition into a question about the state of national politics. Uh-huh. You're in a unique position, or close to unique position, it seems like, with your approach to politics.
Isn't that a sad reflection? If I can just say, to be a moderate and to say that that is an unusual position. I think so many people that I know are moderate people in the middle.
Lots of reports paint you in this way. It seems like you sort of own that, being a moderate, being a centrist. But I don't think I've seen anyone ask you why you think it is that there are, seem like, fewer and fewer representatives who are sort of willing to buck their own party's leadership. And I know there have been studies on that, but I'm curious, in your eyes, why it is.
I think our politics has driven elected officials to what they would define as what is my base, who are the people that have elected me, and you have seen, we don't see it so much here in Alaska. We've got one congressional district, so our congressmen are now our congresswoman. That feels good to be able to say our congresswoman. We've not had a woman, so that's good. But their base is the entire state of Alaska, and the state of Alaska is a pretty diffuse group. You know, you got about 27% of the electorate that affiliate themselves as Republicans, 17 or so that line up as Democrats, and everybody else, the 60-some-odd percent, choose not to be affiliated with one of the two major parties. And so, you know, they may be undeclared, they may be nonpartisan, they may be independent, green, libertarian. So I think for those of us in Alaska to say, well, I have to pay attention to my base, and I'm, you know, doing those in air quotes, it's like, well, who is my base? Well, my base in Alaska is pretty broad. It is pretty broad. And I think in other states, you have seen redistricting push things in a way. You've seen closed primaries push lawmakers to one side of the political spectrum or the other. I think closed primaries have resulted in perhaps the more extreme conservative or the more extreme liberal being the one that is elected in a primary, and then the general comes about, and you know, the two sides duke it out and one absolutely wins and the other side absolutely loses and there's no common ground in the middle. And so if you are, if you're a person from a district that is just overwhelmingly conservative, you are, that's your base that you are going to respond to. And so there is no, there's no middle area. And I think Alaska's a little bit different in that space.
We're getting the rabbit up signal, but if I can ask us really, really one last quick one. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get you out of here, but going off of that question, I'm sure you watched President Biden's speech last week, which a lot of people have called very divisive and alienating, in which he called pro-MAGA Trump supporters semi-fascist and a threat to our democracy. What are your thoughts on that speech?
Well, I didn't watch the speech. I have read the much of the commentary afterwards. I think back to President Biden's inauguration speech, and I did not vote for President Biden. I didn't vote for President, or I didn't vote for Donald Trump in that election either. But when I listened to him and he talked about his desire to unite the country after a very divided election, I was encouraged because I think that's what the country needs. I think the country needs to be united. And when I read the president's very direct words that he delivered, I thought that he is not helping unite the country either. I understand that our former president can be very divisive. We certainly see that play out in the Republican Party. And I know that there are many who feel that, you know, that we need to do everything that we can to stand up and push back against all comments that come from Donald Trump. But I don't believe that all Trump supporters are, you know, the descriptive that President Biden used, I felt was inappropriate. I think it is... it's imperative that our leaders use their words and their stature that they have, that the title brings, with real caution in recognizing that people are listening to that. And I think that leaders have an obligation and a responsibility in their leadership to try to be bringing people together rather than further dividing. And so I have been critical of Trump in the past and will continue to be where I feel it is important. But I want us to try as a country to be working together on initiatives. We spend so much time trying to win elections for our side, and then we just focus on the next election instead of what do we do to then govern once we win. And it seems that more and more we just continue to engage in the battle of winning or the fighting of clawing back after losing. And I think we really need to be focusing more on how we govern as a nation.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, thank you. It's been a privilege, and I wish you safe travels back to Juneau.
Thank you. Thank you.